Hi there. Before we begin, let me explain something. This 12-part series was made at WYSO, a small public radio station in Southwest Ohio. We had financial support from Ohio Humanities, but we relied on WYSO's staff and infrastructure to get the job done. We'd be grateful if you could make a contribution at wyso.org. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Chris Welter, and this is Episode 6, called The 1700s in the Ohio Country.
I'm Nina Ellis. It was a transformative century with many cultures, competing agendas, and high stakes. There was mutually beneficial trade and times of peace, but also brutality and war.
The United States emerged as a nation in the late 1700s. Settlers pushed into the Ohio Country, and the new United States government began a relentless assault on the native people who lived here. From public radio station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio, stay with us. You're listening to The Ohio Country.
If you're a baby boomer, American history narratives and popular culture usually have white settlers, explorers, and frontiersmen at center stage.
Daniel Boone was a man, yes, a big man, with an eye like an eagle and as tall as a mountain was he.
But a new generation of historians is rethinking that approach. Catherine Wilson is related to Daniel Boone. She's a professional historian and the executive director of the Greene County Historical Society.
We are always proud to be descendants of the hardy pioneers. Of course, that was the story that was told at that time, that all these white pioneers strode mightily into the wilderness and tamed it and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm.
Cameron Shriver teaches history at Miami University, and he's affiliated with the Miamia Center there. He works side by side with indigenous scholars and researchers and people like Catherine Wilson, who see early American history and the Ohio Country in a new way.
The U.S., I would say the Old Northwest is really set up to create violence over the territory. So the new United States Empire is premised on an idea that it will acquire Indian land, and that's not going to happen naturally or easily or quickly. It requires a great deal of blood and treasure to make that a reality.
We're going to take some giant steps through history here. In the last episode, we heard about the Spanish arrival in the Western Hemisphere. Then in the 1600s, English, French, and Dutch explorers, missionaries, and traders all arrived in North America.
They brought diseases that killed tens of thousands of indigenous people and caused political upheaval, and they enslaved North American tribal peoples and African peoples relentlessly. The Europeans also brought trade goods that were attractive to indigenous people, like beads, cloth and blankets, metal tools, guns, and alcohol. These transformed the tribe's way of life and created a new economic system. French traders and missionaries went deep into the interior and called it New France. They were trading for furs and spreading Catholicism along the St. Lawrence River Valley, from the Atlantic all the way to the Great Lakes. For 200 years, they traded with the powerful Iroquois Confederacy. It was a lucrative, mutually beneficial trade based on beaver pelts. The French built a string of forts and settlements along the St. Lawrence, where their traders often intermarried with people from the indigenous nations they were trading with, building families together. But by the mid-1600s, the beaver was depleted in that area. The Iroquois moved down into the Ohio Country to get more, and here they came into conflict with Algonquin tribes like the Lenape or Delaware, Miami, Shawnee, and others who were also selling pelts to traders. The so-called Beaver Wars were the result, and most tribes left the Ohio Country, spreading in different directions.
A peace between the Iroquois and the Algonquin tribes was reached in 1701, and the Shawnee came back to their homelands in the Ohio Country and found many new people. British colonists coming in from the east, plus the Lenape and the Wyandot, the Ottawa, the Miami, and the Iroquois tribes, too. There was a tremendous mixing of cultures and economic competition. traders kept coming, and land speculation was hot. Lots of German and Scotch-Irish immigrants came down the Ohio River from Pittsburgh in canoes and flatboats, and overland, too, through the gaps in the Appalachian Mountains to get land, to settle, and maybe to get rich.
The intense competition created a war. The British called it the French and Indian War. And when it ended, the British crown kicked out the French and claimed control of all the land from the Ohio to the St. Lawrence and west to the Mississippi. British claims to ownership over the Great Lakes and the Ohio Country threatened tribal sovereignty. In response, in a conflict known as Pontiac's War, a confederation of tribes attacked British forts to drive them out. The Ohio Country was in chaos. As a result of Pontiac's War, the British crown drew a virtual line down through the Appalachian Mountains, the Proclamation Line of 1763. West of the line was called land reserved for the Indians. Settlers were supposed to stay out, but the chance to own land or to speculate on land was intoxicating. The settlers grew angry and unruly. They saw the king and the tribes as standing in the way of their dreams.
British authority in North America began to crumble, says Dr. Ned Blackhawk in his book, The Rediscovery of America. The settlers formed backcountry vigilante groups, killing tribal people and their allies. And this friction, says Blackhawk, fueled the American independence movement in a way that historians haven't always acknowledged. The American Revolution, says Dr. Blackhawk, wasn't just the Eastern Seaboard colonials' rebellion against unfair taxation. The American Revolution, he says, was just as much about access to land on the frontier, the key to individual and national wealth. At the end of the Revolution, he says, George Washington understood clearly that those settlers were causing chaos.
So he's very aware of these interior spaces, and he's very concerned that all these interior peoples will not follow any form of governing practice. And he says things like, if they leave our boundaries and move into Indian territories, they should become subject to their laws, mm-hmm. that they're no longer fit for our kind of jurisdiction. And so he has a vision of treaty making, of jurisdictional boundaries, of kind of political bilateral agreements of various kinds with Native peoples that would surprise many to hear, but also it's a recognition that he and other founders have of the need for a kind of stronger federalist authority to regulate and govern these interior spaces. So it's no coincidence then when the Constitution is written in December of 1787 that the federal government becomes the arbiter of Indian affairs. It's in the mm-hmm. Commerce Clause that the federal government will adjudicate foreign relations with commerce between the states and with foreign nations and with the Indian tribes.
Dr. Ned Blackhawk, winner of the 2023 National Book Award for The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of American History, which explains American history in a new way. He calls it a more holistic version, a 21st century version that integrates the Native perspective.
But the sad part for a lot of us is that it's been so disregarded that one can take a U.S. history class or a constitutional law class or American legal history class and never know these things.
Dr. Ned Blackhawk, a member of the Timok tribe of Western Shoshone Indians of Nevada, and a professor of history and American studies at Yale University. You're listening to The Ohio Country from public radio station WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. This is episode 6 called The 1700s in the Ohio Country. When the American Revolution ended, the indigenous tribes of the Ohio Country were in a relatively strong position, says Dr. Cameron Shriver of the Miamia Center at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. He works collaboratively with the present-day Miami tribe to tell their story. He calls himself an ally. Shriver says the settlers coming down the Ohio and across the mountains, these new Americans, were in a state of perpetual terror.
The tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of people that are flooding across the gaps, across the Appalachians, a lot of Pennsylvanians coming down the Ohio River on barges that are forted up so that they won't be attacked. Once they arrive in Kentucky, people like Daniel Boone create these forts that are also called stations of homes that are, you know, surrounded by picket fences, pickets to protect themselves. They're in a constant state of fear, terror, dread at the people who own the country, which are the Native American people that are also consistently, I would say, taxing those new Kentucky residents, taking their horses, taking a lot of people, ransoming them in Detroit to the British, and taking a lot of stuff from these immigrants that are coming onto their territory. So it's very clear to the early Kentuckians who has the power, and it's not them. It's the Native people on the other side of the Ohio River, what they call the Indian side of the river.
And the French and the British had been coming down from the Great Lakes, so there's all kinds of alliances going on, and boy, it's turmoil and confusing.
Yeah. Think of Indian country in Ohio, what becomes, you know, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, the old Northwest, as a really cosmopolitan, diverse place. People moving around a lot, really intensive agriculture, a lot of farming hamlets of Native folks who might be Delaware, Miami, Shawnee, Wyandotte, Seneca, Cayuga. All kinds of folks that are living in close proximity in these large farming towns, smaller farming hamlets. Yeah, so it's a really cosmopolitan place, a lot of different beliefs and faith systems, not to mention French descent, descended people, of course, British descended people, African descended people, all living in close proximity and creating families with each other and going about their business in what we now think of the old Northwest.
Don't you think that would have been fascinating to travel through the countryside on horseback and just see this mix of people? There are times when I'm just amazed at what you're describing.
It would have been. And there's a genre of kind of travel diaries and travel accounts from the period where it's just really clear how diverse and cosmopolitan this place is. And so there are a lot of people traveling by horseback, writing their thoughts, coming across just on these roads that are well established, going from town to town. Kind of every day you come to another native town that would have, you know, African descended folks and European descended folks as well. And observing and reporting for us a dizzying array of ethnicities, languages. You know, everyone speaks all these different languages, has familiarity with all these different belief systems, are trading constantly. I mean, this is also a very commercial place, a commercialized place that's pulling in products from China and France and Great Britain and the East Coast through Detroit, typically.
So it was not a wilderness, and it was not, you know, undiscovered and all of that language we hear all the time. It was just kind of, if only it could have gone on like that, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. Wilderness is in the eye of the beholder. So while Eastern speculators are often ignoring the fact that Native people exist, that's a useful ignorance if you want to sell the land, the wealth, if you want to acquire the wealth that is indigenous land. But it's really clear on the ground that Native people do exist, and they make themselves known in Kentucky all the time. So the U.S., I would say the Old Northwest is really set up to create violence over the territory. So the new United States Empire is premised on an idea that it will acquire Indian land, and that's not going to happen naturally or easily or quickly. It requires a great deal of blood and treasure to make that a reality.
But they knew that that was going to happen.
Early U.S. imperialists knew that they were destined to conflict with indigenous people. The way that I talk to my students about this, where we talk about, you know, how do people creating these Indian policies go to sleep at night? You might say the same about, you know, the slavery issue or racism. How do people make this make sense to themselves when they look in the mirror? And so that results in a lot of conflicting evidence and trying to figure out how this acquisitive empire that requires taking native wealth is also a benevolent one. And a lot of hand-wringing goes into trying to figure out how can this be a good empire if other empires are bad.
There may have been hand-wringing, as Dr. Shriver says, but still, a bloody war broke out in the 1780s between the tribes and the Kentuckians who had organized themselves into militias. It was a war within a war. The American Revolution was still raging. At that time, Southern Ohio was home to four divisions of Shawnee, who lived in farming communities like Old Chillicothe on the Little Miami River and 12 miles north at Peckaway on the Mad River. More than 1,000 people lived in each place. And after several years of raids back and forth across the Ohio, General George Rogers Clark, a Virginian, and his fighting force made up of Kentucky militiamen, including former fur trader Daniel Boone, were sent here. They hauled a brass 6-pounder cannon up from the Ohio River and blasted it at the villages and burned their fields. The Shawnee escaped, but a Kentucky militia force came back a few years later and raided Shawnee villages further north in present-day Logan County, again burning fields and homes.
The American Revolution ended, and the U.S. signed a treaty with the British in 1783, but fighting continued with the tribes. With its new constitutional powers, the U.S. government negotiated treaty after treaty to try and create peace and smooth the way for the sale of land and the settlement of the Northwest Territories. They badly needed the money. In 1787, meeting in Philadelphia, the Americans wrote the Northwest Ordinance, a plan for how the territories would be governed and how they would become new states. It famously declared that there would be no slavery in the new territory and, says Dr. Ned Blackhawk, it gave the federal government an exclusive authority to dispossess Native nations. Dr. Cam Shriver reads from Article 3.
The utmost good faith shall always be observed towards the Indians. Their lands and property shall never be taken from them without their consent. And in their property, rights, and liberty, they never shall be invaded or disturbed, unless in just and lawful wars authorized by Congress. But laws found in justice and humanity shall from time to time be made for preventing wrongs being done to them and for preserving peace and friendship with them.
If you didn't know what happened, you'd say, wow, that's really nice attitude. We're going to move ahead here. We're going to be friends. But it couldn't be. It's the opposite of what happened. It's the opposite of what happened. So why that language?
Yeah, it's part, to me, it reads part founding ideals of the United States and part lawyer. So this document, like so many, like the Constitution, this is drafted before the Constitution. So when this is being drafted, the same time period that the United States, its elected leaders are going through the difficult process of rejecting its first government under the Articles of Confederation and moving towards a more central, more active administrative government called the U.S. Constitution. And these are things written by both intellectuals and lawyers. And so the utmost good faith is kind of a legal term coming out of English law that's pretty new, but there's these phrasings that are not entirely clear how they end up written into this otherwise kind of lofty, idealized language of virtue and freedom and liberty, good government, happiness of mankind. These are very generalized terms, and they're just a kind of freely applying them to the United States and its hopeful relationship with people it intends to colonize.
The American Revolution was over, but the Northwest Indian Wars dragged on. In 1790, an American general named Josiah Harmar was sent to subdue the Confederated tribes, and he was overwhelmingly defeated near the Miami village of Kikianga at present-day Fort Wayne, Indiana. And soon after that, the tribes won another decisive victory in Ohio at the Wabash River.
Aye cheke, chechakokwa Wayne's wiane, nilamitasenia mi amiquia. Hello, my name is Diane Hunter. I'm a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. Welcome to St. Clair's Defeat Revisited, a new view of the conflict.
Diane Hunter and a group of other Native women scholars, collaborating with archaeologists from Ball State University and the Ohio History Connection, have created a new exhibit at the site of the Battle of the Wabash. It represents a collaborative effort in Ohio to tell the indigenous version of Ohio's history. This new museum exhibit tells the story of how General Arthur St. Clair's force was trounced by a confederation of tribes. This is the narration from the introductory video at the exhibit.
Marching north from Fort Washington, present-day Cincinnati, Ohio, the 1,400 U.S. troops built a chain of forts. Miami and Shawnee scouts monitored the Army's progress, and runners were sent to other tribes, asking them to assemble in Kikayonga.
For the men to go to battle, they had to explain to the Women's Council why they were going to battle. The women knew how much food was left in their village, knew the condition of the men, knew how many people would be left in the village. They made a vote as to whether, yes, this is important. We had battles because they were fighting for a cause they believed in.
On the evening of November 3rd, as St. Clair and his army camped on the Wabash River, 60 miles southeast of Kikayonga, 1,400 Native troops from 9 tribes assembled on a high ridge just northwest of St. Clair's encampment. The tribes positioned themselves into a huge crescent formation out of sight of St. Clair's army.
Here's the U.S. Army. They're on the Wabash River, and they think they're much further north on the St. Mary's River. They don't pay any attention to the terrain around them, where the Native troops are alert. They're paying attention. They know the land. They have a strategy. They have a plan, and they do it. When you look at that, is it any wonder the outcome?
At dawn the next morning, the Miami, Shawnee, and Delaware attacked St. Clair's army. Simultaneously, the Wyandots, Seneca, and Cherokee on the left, and Ottawa, Ojibwe, and Potawatomi on the right of the crescent surrounded St. Clair's camp in less than 15 minutes.
The crescent formation was a common strategy that had been used by Native forces. This was huge because we had 9 different tribes and a large number of men fighting. What it allowed us to do was to almost surround them. Brilliant strategy. And St. Clair and his men couldn't see us. We planned it and we executed it perfectly.
And that's why it was such a victory for us. We all played our parts. We all did what we needed to. The cooperation between the tribes is what ultimately led to this victory.
Despite the equal number of combatants, the U.S. casualties were enormous. Over 650 U.S. soldiers were killed. Several hundred camp followers were killed or taken prisoner. Less than 50 Native troops were killed. This well-planned Native victory is often called the greatest defeat of the U.S. Army.
The most prominent leaders were indeed Blue Jacket, who was a Shawnee war chief, and then it was Little Turtle, who was with the Miami tribe. They have not been given the credit that they deserve for being leaders. They knew the geography of the land. They knew how to use that land to their benefit, and the American forces did not know that.
My thought, wow, these guys were really smart. It's amazing how we look at it now today. I see so much engineering. They were engineers on designing and thinking out these battles. Very smart and very tactical.
A lot of people think of the tribes as being uneducated and savages, but that's not the case. There are so many different things that the natives did that are not recognized. Having this victory pointed out at a strategy point of view, it shows that we did have intelligence.
When President George Washington learned that another American force had been so badly beaten, he was furious, according to accounts from the time, and he hired a controversial general known as Mad Anthony Wayne and sent him to the Ohio country to try to vanquish the tribes again. That's coming up in Episode 7.
That was Episode 6, called The 1700s in the Ohio Country, written by Nina Ellis. The editor of The Ohio Country is Samantha Summer. The cultural advisor is Dr. John Bickers, assistant professor at Case Western University and a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. Flawn Williams is the audio mixer, and the composer is Evan Miller. Thanks to the Miamia Center at Miami University and Dr. Andrew Carlson of the Department of History at Capital University in Columbus, Ohio. Audio of Dr. Ned Blackhawk was excerpted with permission from the Yale University Press podcast, Episode 108, The Unmaking of U.S. History. Episode host, John Donatich, director of Yale University Press. Episode guest, Ned Blackhawk, the Howard R. Lamar Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University and author of The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. Layla Troyer designed our logo. She's a citizen of the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma. I'm the digital assets producer, Mary Evans. To find photographs, maps, and links, go to wiso.org/podcast. This program is made possible through a partnership with Ohio Humanities, a nonprofit that shares stories to spark conversations and inspire ideas, and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, a More Perfect Union Initiative. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Ohio Humanities or the National Endowment for the Humanities.
To see visual content related to the Ohio Country, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. And for a full transcript of every episode made by humans, go to wiso.org.
Hello again. Now that you've heard this episode, let me explain again. This 12-part series was made at a small public radio station in Southwest Ohio called WYSO. We had financial support from Ohio Humanities, but we relied on WYSO staff and infrastructure to get the job done. So we'd be grateful if you could make a contribution at wyso.org. Thanks.